Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is my friend Steve Greenfield, and he's going to talk about the recent mass shootings in this country. So, hi, Steve. Do you think the mass shootings that are occurring are more frequently done than they were during the Obama administration?
That's a difficult question to confront, because it's trying to establish, I guess, at least a correlative relationship between the Trump presidency and, you know, what is, I guess, a numerically escalated, number of shootings. But it's kind of a difficult thing that I don't like to have at the center of the analysis, because just as an example, the Bundy Ranch standoff, in which no shots were fired, but in which literally hundreds of white supremacists with assault weapons descended upon that overpass in Nevada over the federal lands to shoot at federal law enforcement agents, happened while Barack Obama was president. And if you add all of those people together, there was a lot more of them than any of the people, a lot more of them than anyone, that's the total number of mass shootings that's happened under Donald Trump. And so the real problem that we have is that we have a long-term, very long-term bipartisan failure to address the changes in laws that allowed battlefield weapons for the first time to enter the hands of anyone for any reason, and be used as part of, you know, not home defense, but as we see repeatedly in, you know, large scale operations like the Bundy Ranch standoff, or, you know, smaller scale operations like the politically motivated killing in El Paso the other day, or the hate crime of the Pulse nightclub that was targeting gay people, and things like that have become routine, because both parties are empowering these kinds of murderous radicals to have what we should be treating as, you know, weapons of mass destruction in household possession. And that's really the core issue there. You know, it's easy for two different competing electoral institutions to trade accusations with each other in the effort to attract votes by trying to claim that the source of the problem is only one half of our political system, when the fact of the matter is that the assault rifle ban has not been restored by multiple Democrat, Congresses. Obama had a filibuster proof majority in the Senate, 60 people, 60 Democrats for the first 2 years of his administration. And he did not use it to restore, assault weapons bans and create better definitions of an assault weapon, from firing to, from cosmetic appearances to actual firing capacity, and end this problem once and for all. So the question that I need to be addressing is, why do we have the problem? And as in most of our very, very serious problems, the why we have the problem is attributable to both major parties equally. You know, is one party tending to seek votes from people that tend to wear their inflammatory rhetoric more out on their sleeves? You know, yes. Mm-hmm. Can that be tied directly to enhancing people's sense of motive to actually go out and commit murder? No, I don't think that's the case. I think that the case is, a matter of the bipartisan agreement to maintain this level of firepower in the hands of people with the potential to use it.
So basically, it comes down to the NRA having sway over Congress people as far as contributions.
You know, it has sway over people, and yet, by the same token, the people who claim that they're against the NRA and that the NRA does not hold sway over them, people like Chuck Schumer, who is the Democratic leader in the Senate, who likes to bill himself as the single most anti-NRA, and gun regulatory, pro-gun regulation member of either house of Congress, has never attempted to advance legislation beyond simply filing legislation, which is not advancing legislation. So we have a very aggressive pro-gun movement, and we have only a cosmetically pro-regulation movement. You know, people who want to provide gun regulation credentials as a campaign, as a vote attraction when they're running for office, but while serving in office, do not put any meaningful effort behind advancing legislation. So, it's difficult, again, for me to sit here and state with any kind of authority that the problem is the influence of the NRA, because that influence cannot explain the complete lack of effort on the part of the people who are not, receiving donations from the NRA and get zero ratings from the NRA. How do you explain their lack of resistance to the NRA and their ongoing use of the NRA as a boogeyman to get votes for themselves, despite the fact that they're using that as a veil to conceal that they're not taking any meaningful action to counter the NRA influence? So again, we're left in the same situation, right? The way that the political situation around the gun issue is conventionally framed continues to support the respective electoral interests of the two major parties, right? The Republicans claiming, we're pro-gun rights, and the Democrats saying, we're anti-NRA and in favor of safety regulations. But it doesn't play out in terms of how they conduct themselves in office. And as you know from many, many, interviews with me and, the terms by which I have set my own campaigns for office, I'm not interested in any of that. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I don't have any horse in vote attraction strategies of those two major parties. My focus is on action. And, while you can definitely rely on Republicans to consistently file, bills that make it easier to get guns and make it easier to get very, very high capacity magazines and other accessories that increase the firepower of those guns, you can also rely on the Democrats to provide no resistance to those, to those bills whatsoever. And then to exploit the fact that those bills went into law to attract votes for themselves next time and keep the whole game going indefinitely while thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of Americans a year are getting killed, while these two major parties play electoral games with the issue, with the people that are pretending to be the ones on the side of safety, never actually taking effective action to advance that agenda. That's where I go.
You had run for Congress, and you ran for Congress as a Green, and you ran against the incumbent, John Faso, and the challenger, who is now the incumbent, Antonio Delgado. So let's take the Democrats as an example. Whenever there's a Democrat that is running for office, are they taken aside and whispered in their ear, this is how you will vote. This is what you will say. I mean, it seems like all cookie cutter to me. You know, as a candidate, what's your feeling?
Yes, of course they do that. You know, and that's amply documented, right? I mean, both parties do this, right? They have caucus meetings. That's why you're either caucusing with the Republicans or caucusing with the Democrats when you take office, even if it's in, you know, the county legislature, not just the federal government, right? Even your local county legislature, you know, has a Republican caucus and a Democratic caucus, and they have people that actually have the name. I don't know if it's still Steny Hoyer for the Democrats. There's a position in every legislative body in this country called, you know, party whip, right? The majority whip, the minority whip. They use the word whip because the function of that person is to enforce party unity. And, you know, they enforce it by going to people that are not necessarily on board with party position, by, you know, offering them legislation, offering them some pork, threatening to take away some pork. Like, they actually overtly, both parties use the name. It's a name in each caucus, the party whip. And they get together at caucus meetings, and whoever's the leader, which in this case is Nancy Pelosi for the Democrats in the House and Chuck Schumer in the Senate, and they meet regularly and sit down in a big conference room, and the leader stands up in front of them, and you know, pamphlets are passed around with today's message, and it says, here's what we're doing. And if anybody has any questions about whether they're on board with that, they stay in that room until enough negotiation has been done on, you know, what the leadership is willing to provide to each reluctant member of the caucus in order to get them on board with what's been decided will be their thing. And, you know, then you have at the campaign level, of course, the, you know, the DCCC in the House and its Senate equivalent, and the Republicans have the RCCC and its equivalent in the House, in which the decision of whether or not to allocate money to a candidate is made on the basis of whether that candidate has agreed to conform to the campaign messaging that the people that control access to that money are requiring in exchange for providing both the money and the endorsement of the members of those groups for agreeing to support the agreed upon agenda. And so, yes, you know, it's not even like, gee, it's so consistent that there must be something underlying it, right? It's not like a conspiracy theory. This is done out in the open. You know, they have a caucus, they have caucus meetings, they have caucus leaders. Many of these meetings are actually open to the press, even the ones that aren't. The press is waiting out in the hall, and when the legislators emerge from their caucus meetings, they generally report pretty accurately about what transpired in the meeting and what they're going to be doing when they go to work tomorrow morning and start voting or filing bills or whatever it is was the topic of that caucus meeting. This is not like something about which there's enough data that you just have to suspect that there's something underlying it. It's right there. You know, this is no secret. It's a regular topic of press coverage, and the people that are in charge of it are elected to those positions by their caucus members, and that's those election results are also reported in the press, and the leaders have these, you know, respective titles that are also reported in the press. You know, it's not something you have to conclude by looking at the evidence. It is the open way that the system operates. So yes, they are given these talking points and they operate according to them.
Okay, so somebody who wants to run for Congress, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, people go into certain fields because they want to do some good or change things. Do you think the majority of people who run for office know that once they get into Washington or Albany or whatever the body is, they're going to be just sheep?
Yes. They know that. And I mean, I have known plenty of people because I am, you know, politically involved. I have known many people very young, you know, starting out even while they're still in high school, And then start working their way up through the system, through the committee system, and you know, and they know that that is the case. They know that they are not going to be able to rise through the ranks of their system by being purely idealist. But the way that they rationalize what's, you know, what's going to the gradual corrosion that they're going to be participating with as they rise through the ranks is, and they'll tell you this straight to their face. They'll say it's still better than not doing it, because since that is in fact what is required to rise through the ranks and take higher office, you can't change anything unless you're getting elected. So even if the process of getting elected leaves you with the ability to only get 10% of your ideals actually legislated, that's still better than sticking to, you know, 90% of your ideals but never getting elected to office, so you can't do anything about any of them. They're totally aware of it. They're totally aware that it's the actual career history of the people above them that they look up to and that they're seeking to work for as they climb their way through the ranks. And they know that, that, you know, the every next level that they can go to comes at the expense of another set of ideals to set aside. You know, they completely know that, and yet they are absolutely convinced. And this, you know, look, this may be a realistic observation on their part, right? Not everybody looks at a situation like I do and say, well, if that's really the system, then what you've got to do is crack that system. You've got to tear down mm-hmm. that system and replace it with a system that allows you to keep at least 30% of your ideals, you know, when you're getting elected, right? Mm-hmm. There has to be some minimum standard of the percentage of ideals that you're going to get to retain and actually turn into legislation. And if that, if the percentage falls below some minimum percentage, you're just going to declare that career advancement system to be inherently corrupt and instead switch your effort, instead of making an effort to preserve it and be part of it and continue that 10% floor. A ceiling, rather, in order to continue mm-hmm. that 10% ceiling, you should be aggressively going at it and trying to tear it down and replace it, or at least so significantly challenge it in the ballot booth that it has to change itself in order to survive, right? Obviously, that's my perspective. That's what I do. And I can't personally believe that anyone can walk around considering themselves a good person when they are knowingly contributing their own best effort to preserving that 10% ceiling, you know, so that the next generation that comes up behind them has to have nothing more than a 10% ceiling themselves. You know, I consider that unethical, immoral, you know, and you know, since I care very deeply about my being a good person in the world, that when some level of status quo is obviously inadequate to an essential task, that you first need to change that status quo, right? And here we're talking about gun legislation, right? Gun safety. Sometimes we're talking about climate change, right? Sometimes we're talking about non-defensive war. We talk about, sometimes we're talking about student loans, right? We're talking about a variety of issues, and there's one central theme to why no progress is made on any of these critical issues, which is because the system that we currently have is designed to inhibit changing and moving the football downfield on any of those issues, right? The system is engineered to obstruct that. And so, you know, as you know, as listeners to your podcast know, my goal and the goal of the people that I choose to work with in political action is to tear down those systems, because we can't have a system that prevents us from saving 30,000 lives a year, right? 45,000 Americans right now, even with Obamacare, 45,000 Americans a year are dying every single year from lack of health insurance. 45,000 people, right? You know, how many, another 40,000 are dying from gun injuries, another over and over and over, every, these are, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans a year. So obviously my preference is to, you know, go back a step and get to the source of the problem, rather than say, oh, I'll apply all of my talent and all of my energy to continue providing only 10% effectiveness to an inherently obstructive system. You know, to me, that just sounds insane.
Now, I had seen you in a debate right here in Albany at the Linda, and you debated Delgado and you debated Fasso, and there was another lady that was in the race. But people at the end of the debate walked up to you and says, you know, you're terrific. You make sense. I'd like to vote for you, but, and that but was always, we don't want to do anything to harm the fact that we want the Democrats to win. Okay?
Yeah.
So what you're saying has not resonated down to the people. They still don't get it.
Well, you know, you have to take into account, right, public training, right? What are the sources that most people get their information from, right? They get their messages from the mainstream media, and the mainstream media is constantly telling them, you know, that you know, while overturning the entire system is certainly a wonderful idealistic goal, you know, it's not possible. And even if it were possible, it would take decades, if not centuries, to do. And so what are you going to do in the meantime about the clear distinction between, you know, the two mainstream candidates that you're looking at from the two mainstream institutions, corrupt and ineffectual as they are, right? And that's the message. And so what people have is they have conditioning, right? It's called learned helplessness. There's an actual term for it, you know, in its most extreme cases, it goes all the way to Stockholm syndrome, which is, you know, learning to identify with and support your captor.
Right.
But for the largest extent, it's learned helplessness, right? You grow up your entire life being told by every reliable source, there is nothing you can do. This is the limit. This is the boundary within which you can actually act. And changing those boundaries is beyond your control. There's nothing you can do about that, right? That's what we're told since birth. And so when somebody suddenly walks up to you and says, you know, that's not true. It's a self-fulfilling thing, right? If you believe that you can't do anything, then you're not going to make any effort to do it. And then if you're not going to make any effort to do it, then nothing will have been done, right? That this is a closed loop argument, and that it's killing millions of people, and that should be enough incentive on your part to say, I can go at it. Now, here's another thing, though. And this is a message I would really like minor party candidates and the Green Party in particular to focus on, specifically because of this assumption under which the people that have this learned helplessness, one of the things that they're also told over and over by every trusted source is that people who vote for minor party candidates are people who would fall back to the quote-unquote next closest party if they voted for a major party candidate. And there, I told people all throughout my campaign that my platform was so different from Delgado's, and I even demonstrated to them that there was not a single plank that in which we overlapped. I said, my platform is as different from Delgado's as Fasso's is. There is no next closest party. It's not like Delgado's platform is closer to mine than Fasso's is, and so you could expect my voters to, you know, switch over to Delgado if I drop out of the race. And no matter how many times I empirically demonstrated that by showing them our two platforms, you know, you couldn't crack that presumption that everyone had from the messages they've always gotten from their trusted sources. And yet, when the votes were tallied at the end of the election, I did from 2 to 6 times better in Republican sections of Republican counties of the 19th district than I did in liberal counties. 2 to 6 times better. And at many of the, at, you know, the forums when I spoke I was approached, you mentioned people who approached me at the Linda. I was also approached at other forums by people who said to me, you won my vote and I'm a Republican. Okay, when our platforms as minor party candidates are so distinct from the Democrats that they are equally distinct as the Republicans are, that means there is no presumption of where a voter might default back to if they decide to go with a major party candidate. You know, the Green Party position on decentralized government is very, very appealing to Republicans who cannot help but notice that voting for Republicans is consistently producing massive, expensive, bureaucratic, wasteful, big spending, big government, Republican-controlled legislatures and executive branches, right? They can see, just as Democrats can, that they vote for their preferred party every year, and every year the people they vote for go out and do exactly what they said they wouldn't do. They don't reduce the size of government. They don't cut taxes. They don't demonstrate that switching from public to private, private-based solutions to problems are doing anything but making the problems worse. And they see that. And some of their disenchanted people are just as likely to look for a minor party candidate as a liberal. In fact, more so, because a lot of them are much, much more passionate about these things than liberals are, and much less willing to compromise, you know, which we see in their, you know, regular voting for more extremist candidates, which liberals don't do. Liberals don't vote for, you know, extremely left-wing candidates, whereas Republicans consistently vote for extremely right-wing candidates. And so that is an access point to people. It's just, we just have to drop the whole Democrat, you know, are we spoiling for Democrats? Are our voters likely to vote? That's nonsense. We have to move away from those arguments. We have to publicize the data that we have that shows that we perform at least as well, if not much better, in Republican counties than we do in liberal ones, in Democrat ones, and get away from this, as part of cracking this conditioning that the general public is under from the mainstream media messaging that they're exposed to from birth, we have to create a whole new messaging paradigm that instead of trying to confront that messaging, just ignores it and gives a completely independent messaging of its own, you know, about what I always talk about, right, which is solve the problem. Right. Let's not get into the weeds with all that other back and forth and partisan bicker. Let's, you know, we don't, you know, that's why nothing ever happens, because everybody spends, you know, 98% of their time on trying to distinguish themselves from the position of the party to which they don't belong, and no more than 2% of their time trying to draft legislation that might actually solve the problem. And that's equally true of both parties. And there are disenchanted people whose personal leanings are conservative as well as liberal, who are disenchanted with that and love it when somebody gets up there and says, solve the damn problem, right? Solve the problem. That's why there were so many right-wing people that were supporting Bernie Sanders. People are still trying to unravel the mystery of why a small percentage of Bernie Sanders' primary voters voted for Donald Trump in the general election. And the reason for that is that those people were kind of, you know, they were anti-establishment people, and they were in open primary states, so they don't have to declare a party in order to vote in a primary. And they found Sanders appealing, and when the Democrats left them with Hillary Clinton, they said, well, I'm an anti-establishment person, and I'm going to vote for the anti-establishment candidate. One party did give me or at least what appeared to be an anti-establishment candidate. It is not hard to grasp the psychology of how this happens, right? There are disenchanted people. There are people who see that the problems just never get solved, and that the leadership of both parties actually keep using the fact that the problems go on existing as a way to distinguish themselves from the other party, blame the other party, get votes for themselves. The fact of the matter is that both parties need the problems never to be solved as their way of getting votes. And so, you know, somebody like me comes forward and stands in front of a debate and says, you know, a pox on both of you. These people out here want the problem solved. They don't want to hear talking points by which you distinguish yourselves from each other on the problem while the problem goes on never getting solved. They want the problem solved. And that's why Bernie Sanders got votes from Trumpy people. That's why I did much better in Republican districts than I did in Democrat districts, despite the appearance of me being a flaming leftist, right? Because people want their problems solved. And this gun problem that we arrived here this morning to talk about, right? They shot up the biggest murder in history in this country by a single gunman. Was a country music concert in Las Vegas. Almost everyone there was a Republican. You know?
Right.
They don't want this going on. They don't want this happening. You know, it's not a partisan issue. You know, that's really the way to address it. You know, the Democrats are not passing legislation to make this gun problem even worse, but they are complicit in that they don't block it.
Okay. All right. So what you're saying is it's going to keep on manifesting itself, correct?
Yes, indefinitely, it's going to continue to manifest itself. We're going to continue to be in danger. The degree of danger we're in is going to continue to escalate. I see no light at the end of this particular tunnel.
What would it take for all of these mass shootings to stop?
We need to, as a people, do like what we just saw happen in Puerto Rico 2 weeks ago, right? We have to act. We don't really, forget about, you know, the Democrats don't obstruct the passage of these bills, right? We've been talking about that. But we as people don't obstruct them either. We're not treating this as a serious problem, even though it's killing 35,000 of us every single year. We always have to start looking at ourselves. And again, not people like you and me, right? Because we're obviously in the very tiny minority of people that actually are treating this like a serious problem and are issuing serious demands about something to be done about it. But really, we need to be out in the streets. We need to be having a general strike. We need to tell our employers we're not coming to work until you exert pressure to make sure that I can feel like I can come to work without getting shot. I'm just not coming to work anymore, right? We're not exerting the kind of pressure that historically generates results, even though we see people all over the world right now, not just in the past of great historic successes, but people in the world right now, right here in the United States, 2 weeks ago, a government fell in a United States territory because the people made it clear that the system could not continue to function, that they would not show up for the system, right? Here's the problem. We keep showing up for the system. We keep showing up at work. We keep leaving the streets clear. You know, we keep letting – nobody is standing in front of a weapons manufacturing factory and blocking all the trucks while they're leaving so that their guns and their bullets can't get to the gun stores, right? Walmart just announced, after the shooting happened in a Walmart, they just announced that they're going to continue selling guns, and nobody's blockading Walmart and saying you will not – sell any of the general consumer products that you sell in your massive 110,000 square foot store until you stop selling guns.
Now, here in Albany, whenever there's a peace demonstration or, you know, a demonstration against whatever, you see the same people over and over again. And the average person who works, who struggles to put food on the table, they never show up for anything. What do you do about that?
Well, part of the problem is that the people that go and stand out at these vigils are not really trying to add anyone to their numbers, right? They go out every week and they stand in a park with a sign that says, you know, I'm against whatever, right? I'm against police brutality. I'm against climate change. I'm against war. I'm against whatever. You stand. They stand out there in the park holding their signs every day and waving once every 10 minutes when some car beeps at them, you know, like with the thumbs up or the peace sign or and whatever they do when someone else in a car like gives them the finger, and they stand there. Why are they standing in a park for those 2 hours with their signs instead of fanning out through the neighborhood and knocking on doors, giving those people leaflets? And a phone number to call. And like, why? I've had a problem with the vigil system ever since it started, right? The vigils, the anti-war vigils in on every town and every street corner during the early days of the invasion of Iraq that didn't go home, that finally went home after Obama got elected, even though the war didn't end when Obama got elected, and is still going on to this day. And I, you know, I was always saying to those people, you're standing out here on this corner for social reasons. You come out here with your friends. You have 11 friends that are anti-war, and as part of your bonding, as that this is a shared value you have, the same way that people who believe in God go to church every Sunday morning, and then eat. They have a quick cup of coffee and a donut when the service is over, and they're friends, right? And this is the thing that brings them into physical contact with each other once a week. This is exactly what you're doing. You are standing out here with your 11 friends and that you made signs and that you wave them at motorists and cheer when someone beeps at you is what you do every Saturday morning, you know, instead of going to people's houses the way the Jehovah's Witnesses do, or the Mormons, right? The Mormons walk around your neighborhood every single day of the summer. You see them on Main Street with their short sleeve shirts and their backpacks and their little nameplate. They're there. They fan out around the world. You can't even proceed to college or do anything at the age of 18 if you're a Mormon without going somewhere far from home, in the middle of nowhere, in Africa. In Mongolia, they might send you, you go and you spend 2 years knocking on doors, handing out pamphlets. No Mormons stand on a street corner with a sign that says, you know, be a Mormon. They're knocking on doors. And that's why so many millions of people have become Mormons over the last 100 years. Right? This is the downfall. This is the shortcoming, the essential shortcoming of how people who believe they have strong political opinions completely fail to organize, to add to their numbers, to deliver on those opinions, to make things happen, is because they're standing in a park with a sign instead of knocking on doors, handing out educational literature, you know, going directly to people face-to-face, one-on-one. You know, when you go to people face-to-face, one-on-one, one of the first things they notice about you is that, you know, you're not a crazy person, right? You're a reasonable person. You're saying, look, we've got a problem, right? Climate change. Yes, I know you live in an inner city, but here's how it affects you. A perfect example, right? Something I just posted 5 minutes before this phone call started, which is that there's been a massive increase, 70,000 construction workers since 1992 killed by heat exhaustion, by heat stroke, or permanently disabled from heat stroke, from organ failure, even if they survived brain damage and internal organ failure, from heat stroke on the job as construction workers since 1992. And almost all of this skyrocketing rate of collapse and death and organ failure due to the increasing number of days above 90 degrees every year. Since then,
right?
You know, there's an actual right with our body, and so you can go into an inner city and say, yeah, as a matter of fact, people here are dying because of climate change, right? And because OSHA still won't even establish a temperature requirement over which it's too hot to require a construction worker to work, right? And we know that many of these people are day laborers, right? You see them, they wait outside Home Depot and Lowe's. And small contractors in pickup trucks, you know, hire them for the day for cash. And that's how poor people survive, right? That's how inner city poor people are surviving right now. And they're dying, right? And they're dying because of climate change. They don't necessarily think of it that way until you tell them, until you show them, you know, here's the number of days above 90 degrees every year from 1992 to now. Here's the number of deaths and serious permanent injuries from heat stroke on the job that happens on the job during that same period. Notice that the two curves are perfectly parallel. You know, you go door to door. You don't stand there in a park with your 11 friends every Saturday afternoon holding up a sign that says climate change is killing construction workers. You got to go where there are construction workers, go to their houses. And you know, I don't know when progressives decided that standing in a park with their 11 friends, basically going to their chosen church and not proselytizing and not going out there, not meeting people, not, you know, showing people, not tying people's lives to their own interest in the issue that you came to talk about. I don't know how that started, how that became the norm. You know, but we have to crack that too. It's not just the electoral system that has to crack. We have to crack our own shortcomings as activists.
Wow. Okay. So this is a conversation that definitely will be continued because, as you said, you know, the two major parties are not, you know, really looking at solving problems immediately or in the near future. So you have been listening to Steve Greenfield. So if you like the show, like us on Twitter. Thank you, Steve. We'll talk again. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you.